Okay, let's do some quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. That's obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. To reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. Here's the thing. Information is power. Information is money. Literally, the currency of today's world of entrepreneurship is information. And if you could bring all of the information about your business into one dashboard, this is incredibly valuable. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of the truth about your business. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, access from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all of your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. This is so valuable. You just hit a button and you can see all the information about your business instead of having to like call five different departments and get all these emails and put it all together and make sense of it. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math, see how you'll profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show on the Choose Yourself Network.
FreshBooks, FreshBooks, FreshBooks. Thanks once again for sponsoring the show. If you're a small business owner struggling to get a handle on your taxes, never fear. FreshBooks is here to help. FreshBooks is a ridiculously simple cloud accounting software that will help you cruise through tax season. And believe me, I need it. And their mobile app allows you to take pictures of your receipts and organizes them for later, which makes claiming expenses a total breeze. To get started with a 30-day free trial, go to freshbooks.com/James and enter the code James in the How Did You Hear About Us section. Love ZipRecruiter. I'm so glad they're a sponsor. Oh, should I start the ad? Okay, this is part. Actually, I'll make that part of the ad. Today's show is also brought to you by ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter can help you find the right hire. With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to 100 plus job sites with just one click. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, my listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, for free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/James. That's ZipRecruiter.com/James. One more time to try it for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/James.
Today on the James Altucher Show.
When I used to headline as a comedian, I'd feel sorry for the people lining up waiting to see me. Like I was their weekend. So I want to enter a world where I feel like I'm just starting now. I'm so excited.
It's about reinvention also in the sense that, you know, you started writing these books in your 50s, you're 59 right now. You've had four different careers. I am super happy to have Fred Stoller on the podcast. I'm going to say this, Fred, before I let you speak. You're like television history. You've been on something like 60 different TV shows. You wrote an episode of one of the best TV shows of all time, Seinfeld, and it was one of my favorite episodes of Seinfeld. You've been on, oh my gosh, Friends, Suddenly Susan, Mad About You, Wizards of Waverly Place, wow. Dr. Katz, The Sweet Life of Zack and Cody, The Penguins of Madagascar. You've been on so many shows. And then you've written three books about your television experiences, My Seinfeld Year, Maybe We'll Have You Back, The Life of a Perennial TV Guest Star, and 5 Minutes to Kill, which just came out. It's an excellent book about your experiences in the 1989 HBO Young Comedian special, and you follow the careers of the other people in the special. We'll talk about that in a second. But given what I just said, how would you introduce yourself?
I'd introduce myself as all that, but so self-deprecating, where when people say, oh, you've been on everything, I go, well, not recently. So that I always play the schmucky guy, the nebbish. And when I audition, they go, not so pathetic, and I'm being myself. So basically, yeah, I used to do stand-up. And I had, it's funny being here in New York because some people seek me out. I want to see. A friend gave me a letter from when I first moved to LA in 1988 where I'm saying, I don't want to do the road. So I did the comedy boom in the 80s where you could effortlessly make a living. I never was in love with it. I think I'm over explaining myself.
It's okay.
So I'm really, I did those guest spots and voiceovers, and a lot of it died down, but I'm really happy to trying to write, express myself in my voice. Because for a while, having no self-esteem, I want to be a writer, but I try things out. Oh, that's been done, or that's not what they're looking for, or rom-coms. So finally, as I got so old, where I'm too old to be the guy pitching TV shows or movies, I just wrote what, you know, I'd like to read, which would be, you know, you do a lot of great books, advice and stuff. The best advice for writers is write or read what you'd like to read or watch. So I stopped trying to fit into puzzles. So long-winded. This feels most creative writing, but not writing for like a sitcom or trying to pitch movies. Just writing about this weird guy that I am that got lost finding this place.
It's funny because I want to get into your whole TV stuff and even the stand-up stuff because you address it, particularly in the last book, 5 Minutes to Kill, you address that bridge between stand-up and careers and television and movies and so on. But it feels like, so your first two books, My Seinfeld Year, which describes your year writing on a season of Seinfeld, Maybe We'll Have You Back, which is the five words you always want to hear when you're a guest star on a show. Those are very much like about you and your experiences in TV. I feel there's a very almost literary bent to 5 Minutes to Kill that's different than the first two because it's more, it's still about you, but it takes this almost literary idea of let's take this seminal event, which is the 1989 Young Comedian special on HBO, and let's follow what happened to the other people. That has a little more literary feel to it, even though you also were on that event.
Oh, thank you. You know, the only frustrating thing about 5 Minutes to Kill is people will just think it's just, not silly, but fun behind-the-scenes stuff. When it's a little deeper that, it felt good to get out of my head and, yes, follow the lives. See, I love all showbiz stories or all writer stories. I like reading about, not Steinbeck, F. Scott Fitzgerald more than The Great Gatsby. I like, you know, just people struggling in showbiz, all that stuff. So what I always liked about the special I was on was the six people on it, the diverse trajectory of careers and lives all were fairly compelling and different, you know.
Right, because it was a young Dennis Miller as the MC.
Yes.
It was, you were on the show, and you have the book's called 5 Minutes to Kill.
Because you have five minutes to make your mark on this. See, a lot of young people, like, I don't know how old you are, and I'm sure your daughter and the engineers don't remember how big a deal these young comedian specials were. They launched Sam Kennison, Dice Clay, Seinfeld. This was before Netflix, before Comedy Central, and Jerry Seinfeld had said an appearance on a young comedian special is the equivalent of 10 Tonight Show appearances. And all the young people I'm talking to, the Tonight Show could make a career because you didn't have all these cable and A&E shows with stand-ups. So these were a big deal being on this special.
Yeah, and it was you,
David Spade.
Oh, yeah. So Rob Schneider and David Spade, it was funny. I was listening to Mark Maron, WTF, and he was interviewing Rob Schneider. What was your big break? He said, the HBO Young Comedian Special. Well, what the hell? I was on it. Why wasn't it my big break? What did I do wrong? I'm a loser. I had my chance. So it was those, Rob Schneider and David Spade got cast on SNL because of being on this. A guy you never heard of, Warren Thomas, who Chris Rock referred to as the funniest guy you never heard of, a genius, great guy, Drake Sather, and Jen Karam, who you never heard of, who it was a great tweet from, I'm bad with, Jason Zill something from the New York Times. He wrote a book on Letterman recently, and he's the New York Times. He referred to this.
It's a great book on Letterman, by the way.
Yeah, it is. And he said that this is great writing about, great stories about comics you never heard of. And when I interviewed Rob Schneider for this, he goes, you know, the interesting stories are the ones you never heard of. So being, you know, you never heard of these people, it's just why they didn't make it, why people that were supposed to be the six best young comedians of 1989, what happened and everything. So, yes, thank you for getting that a lot of people don't get that. One person, my friend, said it's almost like the big chill, like six young people and then what happens to them, you know?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, Rob Schneider says he got his big break there. I remember Rob Schneider as more the copy guy in SNL.
Well, he got cast on SNL and they became aware of him from this.
Yeah, and I guess with David Spade, I remember him more from Just Shoot Me, which ultimately led from this, the comedy special.
But their break was Saturday Night Live, which they got from this, yes.
Yeah.
Well, what happened with Just Shoot Me is, he left SNL because he was repped by Brillston Gray, who, Brad Gray plays a prominent part in my the book, and he just died like 2 days ago.
Yeah.
And so they were producing, Brillston Gray, a sitcom for Laura San Giannomi, is that how you say it?
Yeah, San Giacomo.
Yeah, so he was with such big management, they put Spade on the show, but then he stole the show. She was supposed to be the star of it, the anchor of it, but he became the breakout star of Just Shoot Me.
So it's interesting to me because if someone had told you when you were a kid, oh, you're going to be on the 60 best TV shows of all time, you're going to write one of the best episodes for one of the best TV shows of all time, and then you're going to write three great books about television, you would have said, oh, I'll take it, sign me up.
Well, yes and no. You know, well, it's a lot of these memoirs are coming to terms with, you know, like my mother is not very accepting. And well, she just puts me down. How come you'd have been a regular? So maybe we'll have you back. As if you remember being an insider, outsider guy. I'm on these shows, but it's frustrating because you're hearing them talk at the craft service table about their second houses, what they're going to wear to the Emmys. And they're coming back the next week. And I describe it as I'm like a foster kid from TV shows, hoping one keeps me on. So yes, as I got older, I learned to say yes, that's something, because I forget, because Hollywood, as you remember from the opening of 5 Minutes to Kill, what it's like living there, I don't know if you go there often, but it's all these billboards in your face of these idiots you started with smiling, hey, you loser, I'm on a TV show, I'm working. So you lose perspective that I grew up in Sheepshead Bay in Brooklyn, and two of the guys are dead. One still lives with his mother on Brown Street in Brooklyn. So yes, you lose perspective how awesome it is. Just when I was on Seinfeld, I remember... I wrote on Seinfeld and it didn't work out. They didn't bring me back. And then they called me to get down here quick for a table read. And I remember I didn't know what I was going to be, but driving there, I said, I don't care if it's one line to be in Seinfeld in any way. And, you know, the magnitude. So the scene I was in, the first scene was in Monk's Diner. And just to be, I'm sure people who were extras were... just to be in Monk's Diner was amazing. So now I don't take it for granted, but yes, it still was a struggle because here you are on these shows, you're recognized, people think you're rich. I remember these guys, in the Grove would say, he must live up there, pointing to Hollywood Hills, and I want to correct them, point her arm to where I really live. So people think you're rich or you're famous, or people would stop me. Hey, do you need a writer's assistant? What? I need someone to help clean my little apartment. So yeah, it's just, I learned to really enjoy being, you know, because I used to like people, you're so funny. I go, then how come I've never been a regular? What am I doing wrong? So yes, a lot of these books are about coming to terms. What does make it mean? Self-acceptance. Because like I said, you're in a warp city where it's in your face. Like one comic, I forgot, said, it takes 5 minutes to read the Hollywood Reporter and a whole day to get over it. Because, you know, you're going, damn, look at this.
But again, it's all about a perspective.
Yeah, like
you're
exactly.
No matter where you are, you're always kind of comparing yourself to the next person. Like, I literally know billionaires who compare themselves to people with $10 billion and they get upset.
Exactly. So I used to say, why am I not a regular if I'm so funny? I've never been a regular on a sitcom or this or that. But yes, I learned, I don't know how old your daughter is. How old is she?
18.
And to me, one of the biggest joys I have, I don't know if you watch Drake or Josh or any of those shows.
Yeah, she does.
I only was on one Drake or Josh, but the foam finger guy with the eye patch, bobblehead. I was on Wizards of Waverly Place. Did you see that? So just to be part of someone's childhood is, you know, I'll have a depressing day, whatever. And then just some kid would recognize me. And because I know growing up, I loved the Bob Newhart show, and I got to work with Mr. Carlin, one of the guys from it, or being friends sort of with George Segal, who I'd see in these 70s TV shows. So, yes. Yeah, so, you got to get the perspective back. And that's why it's good to be here. New York is insane, but to get out of Los Angeles.
Well, now, there's a lot of different directions I want to go with this. One thing is you are incredibly funny. Like, so I watched the 1989, you know, HBO special when I read the book just to see your, you know, 5 minutes, 6 minutes. And it's hilarious.
Oh,
like,
if
I saw that right now, it would be hilarious. Like, the humor sticks. Like, you say, you know, first off, I love how you start, which I plan on stealing, actually, if I do a talk or something.
Have you ever talked?
No, like, no.
In a public speaking.
Yeah. Yeah, like how you say, you know, where are you from? And then, okay, over here. And then, you know, you kind of just go quickly.
I never knew how to open. So all these comics work the crowd. Oh, I'm psyched. Let me at you. Yeah, it was so hard because the hard thing about opening as a stand-up is you got to get them, but you can't do your best joke, which would be ideal because they're trying to figure out who you are. So that's why a lot of comics open with a joke like Rob Schneider. I know, I'm short. We breathe down or whatever. So yeah, so I would just sort of work the crowd, but not really.
Yeah, that was funny. And then you have the joke where, you know, I don't always, I'm going to misdo it, but I don't always, I'm not always so close with my mom. So I wrote her this letter, you know, dear Mrs. Stoller.
Right.
You know? So just all of these things are so self-deprecating and funny in this twisted way. Or then you write about how in some of your stand-up, you have these kind of non sequitur jokes that are really funny when you think about it. Like, I'm so poor, I can only buy cars that are blue.
Something. You know? We could only afford a blue card. No, those were non-jokes. Jokes that sounded like their jokes were just missed.
But those are funny.
They would never work in clubs. I did them at the comic strip. This guy goes, that joke sucks. Like, he didn't get.
The idea that it sucks is what makes it funny.
Right, right. Now, well, the problem was that set you saw, I hear my accent, saw, Brooklyn, I did the comedy boom of the 80s where you could just make a living doing 15 minutes here and there. Then you go on the road to do 45 to an hour and you had to adapt, which I didn't know how, and go, hey, here I am in Austin or, you know, San Antonio. You couldn't just, you had to cater to them to show you're on their territory and follow some middle act that was doing flips and rapping and spitting at the audience and cursing them out. So my low-key, depressive, non-sequitur weird jokes, it kind of had to get watered down when I went on the road because you couldn't just be this whatever. Yeah.
But so let's get in. Again, there's many directions I want to take this, but first let's get into why you didn't really break out with, let's say, your own show, because I feel like there obviously could have been a character or a show based on it. But you were on Everybody Loves Raymond. You were on 6 episodes. You kind of played a consistent character, his cousin Gerard. And I feel like in that show, they call you out for the problem you have, which is that you always sound depressed in every single show.
Nasally and whiny. And
Raymond tries to get you to say now,
yes,
not depressed.
right. Yeah, now. Yeah, I say it like he does. Yes. I mean, are you going to say, why was it I ended more? Or
just why, maybe?
Well,
like,
James, sorry to interrupt, but that's the frustration, even though, like you said, it's amazing that I was on the shows, but when people would say, you're so funny, how come you never made it? Or, you know, or they think I'm a millionaire, or, yeah, why don't you have your own show? That's when I beat myself up. Yeah, what am I doing wrong? So it, in a sick way, got frustrating because, like, yeah, like people were complimentary. I would speculate that, like during the 90s or whatever, a lot of comedians were getting their own shows. I'm not an anchor, you know. I'm the weird guy that pops up.
But why? I think you could have been an anchor, though. Why do you, I think you probably were too. I think you absorb this self-deprecating persona, which probably is maybe your real persona.
But
you absorbed it too much, so you wouldn't push shows.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. Yeah, no, I was in the wrong era. I'm older than you, but I grew up with shows like Barney Miller, where they had these weird ensembles of, you know, or Bob Newhart, like a weird patient that comes in. You know, actually, I never had the confidence to dream big. I never thought I could be a star. I identified with the weirdos that had 3 lines. Oh, I could be that guy. And there was a guy in Dog Day Afternoon who chickens out. And I go, I could be that guy. I remember I was seeing a shrink in New York. I said, yeah, that's my dream. He goes, you should dream a little bit higher. and I go, yeah, maybe he's right. Because I, when I used to headline as a comedian, not good self-esteem, I'd feel sorry for the people lining up waiting to see me. Like, I was their weekend, you know, and they're spending their weekend money on me. I guess I never, yes,
but had that entitlement. Why would you feel that way, though? Like, if everybody says
Well, we could go to my mother and my, all that stuff.
But if everybody says you're funny all the time, why wouldn't people line up to see you?
Because it wasn't, I'm not like an entertainer, you know, for a headliner. I think I was good in New York in those 15 minutes spots at the comedy clubs or not as a headliner. The headliner had to be entertaining, high energy, do an hour. You know what I'm saying? And when I headlined, no, they were disappointed. They would switch the middle act with me, who had a guitar, and you know what I mean? Make them clap along and curse, you know, and work the crowd. That's why when I did that opening, you like, hey, I'm working the crowd. I was mocking those comedians that, hey, look at this schmuck. Who takes the pictures? A threesome, hey. You know, and they would blow the room away. And that's what those crowds wanted, you know. Not the non-sophisticated crowds.
But, you know,
I was in high energy. They liked high energy.
Take like Barney Miller, though. So Fish was kind of the low energy guy, but he ended up having his own show.
Because he was... He was on Barney Miller, but you know
you were on Seinfeld.
Yeah, just one. He was a regular.
Yeah.
I don't know. I could say why it didn't work out that way. I would have liked it. Yeah, but I think it was a different era in that you wouldn't have a show like Mary Tyler Moore, a bunch of middle-aged, not good-looking people. They're like slick, like How I Met Your Mother, or you know, Friends. Friends kind of maybe Friends changed it where they're really good-looking, young, fashionable people in prime time. Like I said, How I Met Your Mother, or the people on, what's that other one? On Always Sunny in Philadelphia, kind of slick. And so, yeah, I think I'm from the era of the more nebbish. Now they have all these UCB people that are kind of brooding and they're deadpan, but they're kind of like nerdist. They're too hip, you know what I mean? They're like on The Office. They're low-key, but it's like deliberately like cool, like, Yeah. Well, the slobs on purpose. So I think I should write an article, the difference between a nebbish and a nerd. Nerds are cool now, but they're more like pop culture references. They're snarky. They're like a guy, you know, guy Brian Posehn. He's like he's not good looking, but he acts like, yeah, I'm into Metallica. They just riff on pop culture. And
he was on the Sarah Silverman show, right?
Yes, yes. Yeah. So obviously he's not a good looking guy. Sorry, Brian. He says it too. But a nerd is more like a guy into, yeah, I have my collections of this. I you know, one thing bothered me a little bit. Him and Patton Oswalt were on some documentary, The Comedians of Comedy. And Patton Oswalt's gone, yeah, I'm into comic books. I'm different. You know, if people don't get it. No, you're not different. That's so mainstream. That's not, you know, alternative. I hate when people go, I'm going to Comic-Con. I guess I'm a nerd. No, you're meaning I'm cool. I'm into robots and anime. So I got resentful that the nerd, Chris Hardwick, the nerds, hijacked the word nerd, and it's cool.
You know, it's funny, just as a little trivia fact that I just heard yesterday, the San Diego Comic-Con just started selling their tickets, I guess, a few days ago.
Oh, it sold out probably the symposium.
146,000 tickets sold in 45 minutes. So there's 146,000 like instant nerds.
So that's why, yeah, but nerd means cool now. So yeah. So I think I'm from the era of that kind of more sad sackish. Yeah, which you don't see. I mean, to tell you the truth, though, of all the things I've done, these things, expressing myself in my own voice has been, you know, being creative and expressing myself. Well, I'm always trying to fit into other people's puzzles my whole career.
Well, in 5 Minutes to Kill, you kind of present many. So 5 Minutes to Kill, your latest book, I highly recommend it.
It's really only $1.99, these Kindle singles.
Right, not even $2, as you pointed out on Twitter.
Yes.
So there is a difference between the guys who broke out, which is like David Spade and Rob Schneider. And then you're sort of in the middle there, mm-hmm. Fred Stoller. And then you have, you know, Jan Karam, Warren Thomas, and I can't pronounce
it. Drake Sather.
Yeah, so what is the difference between the first group
Again, it's hard because, you know, talking to me right now, we can't figure out why blah, blah, blah. I didn't become the guy, the regular guy, or the sad sack on the shows. But talking to a lot of these people, interviewing all the people for this, a lot of people, let's say, came from San Francisco where they're rock stars in the comedy boom, and it's creativity. And this is stuff you should explore because you write about, you know, packaging and, you know, and business. And there's a way to, you come to Los Angeles, to Hollywood, and you got to figure out how to take what's unique about you and sell it. Because when you're the kings of your local town or San Francisco, where, like I said, they're rock stars, it's about being creative and riffing and this and that. Like Warren Thomas, who Chris Rock referred to as I said, the funniest guy you never heard of, he was what they called riffers. In San Francisco, the late Robin Williams, only Warren Thomas, this guy Stephen Pearl, and Greg Proops, who you probably heard of, they could keep up riffing. It's just going and references, you know, like Whose Line Is It Anyway, sort of, but just almost like battle rapping, but just keep it going off stage. And so Warren Thomas had a very loose, almost like a jazz player. And he almost thought it was lame to have a structured set, which hurt him. Even on the Young Comedian special, as I wrote, it was, he was like trying to come up with stream of consciousness. And David Spade, what are you doing? You know, so I like to just find my way as I go. So Warren, I don't think, was structured that way. Now Robin Williams made it almost like a magician, made it look like he was just coming up with stuff. But he had tricks. He would do a lot of the same, quote unquote, spontaneous stuff at the always same time. So he created the illusion of the spontaneity. So I think it was a lot of them with structure. Jan Karam, she was a precursor because she was beautiful. She still is very, very attractive, very beautiful. But she was before this influx of comedians that were attractive. There were very attractive comedians before. Amy Schumer, Sarah Silverman, Whitney Cummings. Is that her name? Yeah.
Yeah.
But they were more kind of the 80s aggressive or a kind of punch, punch, punch. Comedians Elaine Boozler, Carol Leifer, you know, people like that. Paula Poundstone. But then women start talking really graphically, sexually, and they own their hotness. Now, Jan was the first really beautiful comedian that was just sexy and was, but I think she didn't own her hotness. Like Sarah and Amy, they talk very graphically, and but Jan, again, I don't know. It's timing. It's luck. If you people listening read the book, Jan had some timing issues. She looked too much like Elaine. She knew Seinfeld. She dated. She could have been Elaine, but then they were concerned. You're too beautiful that people are going to be mad at Jerry. You broke up with him. So just these rant. So in my book, I explore what does make it really mean? Because like you said, people compare themselves. David Spade, Rob Schneider go, why aren't I Adam Sandler? Why aren't I whatever? So it's, yeah. So it's these different paths and different things happen.
You know, a lot of it seems, has to do with persistence. Like Jeffrey Tambor writes in his memoir that just came out that Brian Grazer, the producer, once told him, this is what a Hollywood career looks like. No, 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 no. And,
yes,
you know, that's basically, it's almost like you have to persist through all those no's to get, and that's true for any career, but it seems particularly true when you're selling yourself as the product.
Right. I think with the 1989 Young Comedian special, though, that was on the cusp of when comedy was getting fashionable and cool. And I got to give David Spade credit. He was a precursor to the snarky kind of, you like on those shows, Best Week Ever, or those I Love the 90s, those talking heads. Yeah, yeah, you're really cool. You know what I mean? The wise asses. So I think youth helped David Spade and Rob Schneider because they were kind of bad boys. Like Schneider had the leather jacket and or whatever. He was fashionable. He was half Fonzie, half Elvis. You know what I mean? So they had an attitude. So I agree with persistence, but it helped that they kind of got their thing, you know what I mean, with that coolness.
They had a persona that somehow fit.
Well, because when I went into stand-up comedy, I never went into it, I want to be cool. This is cool. I was just, you know, I was pathologically shy and depressed. That's why my mother freaked out that I quit college to be a comedian. Because what? You're so depressed. How are you gonna make people laugh? Don't quit. What are you doing? But again, I wanted to be a character actor, but I didn't know how you did it. So then I heard, I see people like Jimmy Walker, and someone said, "Oh, he did his set at the Improv, and then you go on the Tonight Show, then you're on a sitcom." I said, "Oh, even though I'm really shy, I only have to do it two times. I'll do the Improv, get discovered, going to the Tonight Show." I fantasized going to the Tonight Show, going, "Oh, this is only my second time doing stand-up." So I said, "I only have to do it once." And obviously I didn't get the Tonight Show, but I'd have my head down. I couldn't look at the audience. And that became my persona because I was so pathologically shy. So then around the Young Comedian special after, then there was things like the half-hour comedy hour on MTV. So comedy started becoming cool. You never had really, you had people like David Brenner from my era, never good looking people, Robert Klein, not unattractive, but not so long winded thing. What I'm saying is, I think it became a lot about it helped that persistence with Jeffrey Tambor. He's like a bold character actor. So it worked with him, but I think the timing for Rob Schneider and David Spade that they were. And, you know, Saturday Night Live, the kind of, you know, cool bad boys.
Let's stop to take a quick break. We'll be right back. FreshBooks. Thanks once again, FreshBooks, sponsoring this podcast. Here you go. If you're a small business owner who struggles with tax stuff,
You don't have to stress anymore. Because freaking out and burying your hand in the sand will, trust me, will not solve your problems come tax time. FreshBooks is the ridiculously easy-to-use cloud accounting software that's made for people who can't stand doing their taxes. Seriously, FreshBooks will transform the way you will handle your taxes because they keep all your cash flow details in one place so you know exactly what invoices you sent, who has paid you, and what your actual income is. And their mobile app allows you to take pictures of your receipts and organize them for later, which makes claiming expenses a total breeze. You can even set up FreshBooks to import expenses directly from your bank accounts. It's everything you need to stay completely zen come tax time and not panicked at all. For a 30-day free trial, just go to freshbooks.com/James and enter the top secret code James in the How Did You Hear About Us section. That's freshbooks.com/James and enter the code James in the How Did You Hear About Us section. If you're hiring, you need to know where to post your job to find the best candidates. And believe me, believe you me, I know finding great talent can be difficult. Thankfully, with ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to over 100 websites with just one click. In fact, over 80% of jobs posted on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate in just 24 hours. You can find candidates in any city or industry nationwide. Just post once and watch your qualified candidates roll in to ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. You won't have to juggle emails or calls to your office. You can just quickly screen candidates, rate them, and hire the right person fast. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, my listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/James. That's ZipRecruiter.com/James. One more time. To try it for free, go to ZipRecruiter.com/James. Let's talk about the Seinfeld year for a second. So you started, you know, you ran into Larry David. I guess you knew him from stand-up
Yeah,
days.
What happened was a mutual friend, Steve Scrovan. I knew Larry David from the stand-up days and the improvisation.
How was he as a stand-up before pre-Seinfeld?
People say, you know, he was very well respected with comics, but he's like he is on Curve, not as ridiculous. But my explanation is the things he does, those outbursts, he may not have them, but these things he thinks, oh, why'd you get that seat? And how come you get a phone? You know what I mean? Like, he won't scream at you, but he wants to. So he would just storm off the stage if they weren't laughing or a guy had his head turned. So he really wasn't a road comic. Like, I had to do a, you know, consummate. He wrote, I guess he wrote on Friday. So he was respected where the people who didn't know things that this guy is brilliant, but not really a club comic. So, but I remember I'd hang out at the Improv. I remember when he said, let's see who could go the longest without masturbating, but you got to be honest. And that became the Seinfeld episode. So I went to a surprise birthday party for my friend Steve Scrovan, and he came later because he goes, I don't want to have to yell surprise. You know, that was stupid. And he was always sort of a bully to me, like, when's the last time you got laid? I can't picture anyone ever loving you, you know? You're a sad-sack loser like me, is my Larry David impression. And he goes, well, what's wrong with you, you know? So then they were using a lot of stand-ups as writers on the show, and people were pitching ideas, spec scripts, you know what that is, where it's yeah. He goes, how come you never wrote a spec script? I go, I don't like the idea of writing something that it's just a sample of your work, something, you know. He goes, write one. Nothing will happen, but I will read it. And I wasn't going to do it because I'm not smart, like savvy, like you. You know, I love this. Actually, I'll relate something you wrote to something on Seinfeld. But business, I didn't know. I thought when you got a job on a sitcom, that was your living. Most sitcom writers were five jobs ahead, like these Harvard guys with. On lunch breaks, we'd go to Castle Rock and getting the next deal because they were writers on Seinfeld. I was not smart and that way. I'm not a business guy. So long way of explaining that I never, you know, there's some comedians they wanted to be the guy at the table, what's his name, Rob Petrie from Dick Van Dyke. I never wanted to be a TV writer, you know. So, but I said, I have to write this spec script because the fact Larry David will read it, there were people in 1994 that would kill to have Larry David, because I don't have to explain to people what a phenomenon Seinfeld was.
And also the fact that Larry David was really the runner of that show. He more than Jerry Seinfeld at that time.
Right. So I wrote a spec script based on true incidents. One of them was, this is before the internet, where if you had a blind date, you couldn't do research now. There's no such thing as a blind date anymore. You put your name, James, you know, oh, this is what he looks like. Oh, yeah, he's done all these books. Cool. I'm excited. You know, with me, I'll have a date and a woman will, they'll look me up on this thing that's not true, celebrity net worth. It says 1.5 million, no. Or they think I'm rich because they see all my credits. They don't know a lot of them were free or $300. So someone said, I have this woman I want to set you up with. Oh, she's for the summer at Cape Cod. And I was so excited. What does she look like? So I thought of like a sketch where I hire a police composite artist to have my friend describe her so I could look at the picture, go, ooh. So he goes, I like That's that funny. Composite story. So I somehow led to being a staff writer where Seinfeld is different than other sitcoms in the fact most writers, sitcoms have a table. The writers sit around and they come up with story ideas. James, you write that one. Seinfeld, you were on your own where you had to come up with stories and people weren't really helping you. My analogy, it's like a homicide. Everyone's trying to solve their own murders, but their own. We're all trying to solve murders. So we're all trying to write Seinfeld episodes. So you couldn't write anything until you got your Jerry, Larry, Kramer, and Elaine story approved and connect them. So I'd just be on my own. And just
to interrupt there, it's interesting that every main character had to have a story.
Yes, and you had to connect them.
Yeah, and that was kind of innovative that was sort of a Larry David innovation for Seinfeld as opposed to prior shows like MASH or Taxi. Yep, yep. Not necessarily every character had a storyline every show.
Yep, yep. Well, yeah, I wonder if it's because they were such iconic people.
I think Larry David, he's mentioned that he just didn't want the other guys to sulk for the week.
Well, no, actually what happened with me was I wrote this Kramer story based on this character I knew who was this eccentric guy and didn't want his refrigerator anymore. He wanted more space, which, and I had this funny scene of him putting the refrigerator on his back, going down the steps, wobbling, all that physical stuff Kramer does, and they Jerry and Larry rewrite your script when you hand it in, and they really cut a lot of his stuff. So when I was at the table read, I thought Michael Richards Kramer was sulking, like, I don't have a lot to do here. So I went over to him and go, you know, I thought he was mad at me, and I said, I wrote more for you physical stuff. You look upset. You don't have a lot to do. He goes, oh, I love doing the physical stuff. Can you tell Larry to put it back in? So I knew it wasn't a good idea, but I'm, whatever the word is, codependent, where you want to please everyone. So I go over to Larry David. I go, Michael Richards is upset. Can we put some stuff back? I go, you don't talk to the actors. What the hell's wrong with you? Oh, what an idiot I was. Yeah, so one thing, I know you wrote that thing about only having 15 possessions.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's funny. When I was younger, I was like the 40-year-old virgin where I had knickknacks and action figures. And as I get older, you know, I like having less and less. Even though the sound isn't as good on, what is it called? You know, with CDs with digital, I like being more of a minimalist as I get older. So when I knew I wasn't coming back, so at first, you know, when my season, I had an office with knickknacks. I remember, I don't know why, a Whoopi Goldberg from Star Trek figurine. I didn't even like Star Trek. All these knickknacks and toys. And I knew I wasn't coming back. So each day I take more and more stuff home. And then when it was the last day, it wasn't like I had to pack boxes. So maybe I'm getting deep. I think like life, you know, I dated this woman many years ago, Jerry Stiller's daughter. And I remember Jerry Stiller had all this memorabilia and stuff. This is me on Ed Sullivan. This is me in TV Guide. And I said, I don't want to, well, he's not lonely, but I don't want to be a lonely guy sitting in my room with all my knickknacks and memory. Here I am. Here's my picture. Here's my script from Suddenly Susan. You know, so as I got older, maybe it's like Seinfeld where I'm waiting to die. No, I'm just kidding. like Seinfeld, I'm waiting to get fired here. I'm waiting to, she gave a look like she's worried.
Why are you waiting to get fired? I know, so one question.
You just know because,
I know Larry David kind of wanted to circulate writers because he was afraid he'd run out of New York stories about comedians. So he'd want to get a new.
And you know when, that I was there when it was starting to bring in those Harvard guys that really, I remember two of them, one of them said to me, you always use stuff from your life. Nothing bad ever happens to me. I have to make things up. I go, how could you say nothing bad ever happened to you? But, you know, but so they what happened was you just know because you just sense when you're not part of it.
But when you had that conversation with that person, nothing bad ever happens to you. You did then write a list of all these crazy Jerry ideas that you had that didn't actually happen to you. Why didn't you pitch those? They were very funny.
I was trying on like the non-jokes. Sometimes writing non-jokes by accident, the real joke comes. So I'd come up with the most ridiculous things. And I think when I did pitch, like Manute Bol was a basketball player I liked because he was skinny. He was like, you remember him? 7'6", 60 pounds. So I said, Jerry gets Manute Bol mad at a basketball game. And what the hell's that? You know, so I think it's like a woman. I learned in life, you know how you get a woman to like you? She has to like you. It doesn't work with being like John Cryer and Pretty Woman and seducing them and dancing. Anytime I try to get a woman to like me, it doesn't work. It's almost predetermined, like auditions. So I knew, I was really struggling to get another storyline approved. And what happened was I pitched speaking of that, Paul Reiser did a thing where Patrick Ewing got mad at him at a basketball game on Mad About You.
Well, in Curb Your Enthusiasm, I think Larry David tripped a basketball player.
Yeah, so, you know, the thing is, I'm not saying they stole things, but it's like a chemistry, like I said. Like, if a woman, like, I'll say something to a woman, and she'll look at me, I'll be the same guy, like, I'm Hinckley, you know? And then to another woman, I could be Johnny Depp, or the early Johnny Depp, you know? So, you know what I mean? So it's not even what you say, it's just, like, I learned, like, I did a movie I wrote that went to festivals. Well, no, I learned when I was, when you write your Seinfeld episode, you're in on the auditions. So you always beat yourself up. Like, it's almost like you walk through the door. You're the guy or girl or not. So, you know, you could do all these fancy tics. You know, I'm not going to be on Law and Order as a gritty detective. You know, it doesn't matter how much acting coaching I get. I walk through the door. Here's this weird guy, you know, whatever. I just exude this. So what I'm trying to say is I had a lot of ideas that they ended up using on Seinfeld, almost like they were shut off. So when you see people auditioning, they're not right because they're not right, not because they're not good actors, you kind of just shut off. So I just knew Larry was shut off to me. And what happened was I handed in my second script. He goes, I'm not doing it. He goes, no point in starting anything else up. The season's almost over. So there's 6 weeks to go, and it was almost like a Seinfeld episode they did where George was fired. He wasn't sure if he should come in. So I said, I want to get my 6 remaining checks, so I guess I'll come in. So I'd come in, get the free lunch, walk across the street, play pinball, and then go home. So little by little, there were 5 other writers that had that same thing.
So I'm just putting myself in that mindset, right? So let's say I had written a script for Seinfeld, and it was a great show. It was the episode The Soup, which was very funny. And I would then think to myself, okay, I'm going to pitch some shows, good or bad, but some studio will give me a 3-show deal or whatever.
Again, you know, I think you mean to get another writing job.
Yeah.
Yeah, again, I think I was so decimated, my confidence as being a writer, that before that I was starting to get some work on Murphy Brown, whatever, Amen, some guest star work. And I kind of, to me, a sitcom writing isn't creative. Yes, if you're smart and you want to have a house and a family and, you know, that stuff, there, you know, again, there are people in Harvard that study to be sitcom writers. It's a business now. It wasn't a business. Yes, I'm not like you. I never had a business sense. Like I said, I didn't know that I was supposed to go to lunches. Oh, well, here's a funny story. You know who, do you watch Entourage?
Yeah. So Ari Emanuel
is a real person. So he said, you know, I said, I got the job. He found that I got the job. He goes, I'm going to be your agent. And he goes, I'm not going to take a commission. I want to cultivate a relationship with you. So then I guess he sees I didn't exude that kind of whatever, that wheeler-dealer guy. Then like early on, he stopped returning my calls. He so much was cultivating. You know, you just get it. Like I said, TV writing is a business. This is like going into Wall Street now. It's like they learn the formulas. They write. You write in the voices. When you create a show, you write, it's your voice. When you write on a show, you're writing in someone else, the showrunner's voice. A lot of people some people eventually in Seinfeld, like Alec Berg, runs with Mike Judge Silicon Valley, which I love. But a lot of them, a lot of Simpsons people, never created their own show. They just are smart and know how the formula and what if Jerry does this and stuff. So yes, I really didn't see. So then when I snuck out, they said, don't do anything. I did a part on Murphy Brown and I started doing some more of the guest stars. And then when I was let go from Seinfeld, I started getting some guest stars. So that got me, I was so embittered from the sitcom experience that I didn't go that route. I have an apartment and not a house, you know, and all that. Yes. Yeah, so.
Well, let me ask, this is just kind of, sort of the basic economics question. You've been in so many shows. I mean, there was one show where you've done the voice on 84 different episodes.
Yeah, I got lucky with Handy Manny, a kid's show where I was the monkey wrench, and that was great. So, yes, a preschool, Tools That Talk. So I had a little nice run with animation for a while.
And you get residual checks from all these shows?
Not insane. Not like guys like Phil Rosenthal from Everybody Loves Raymond. But they go down and down and down. But they're nice little things. I had my landlord look me up. He goes, hey, you should pay more rent. You know, I didn't know you work so much. And he goes, he wanted me out. He can't kick me out, but he was resentful. Because, you know, he can only raise my rent 3%. So it's like when he looked me up on the computer, it's hard for him to get him to fix things because he thinks I should own a house by my resume. So no, what are you trying to say? No, I'm not doing a sob story. I'm very fortunate. What happened was, because I don't have a mortgage or kids, and because I did that animation, I wasn't strangled and desperate. So then I started writing these things because I go, you know, what would I like to write without trying to make the big sale? Well, you know, so it really, you know, they say money, blah, blah, doesn't buy happiness and all that. But to me, money buys, for me, not being desperate. And that's why with the possessions, you know, you wrote about, I like that. I like, to me, what money buys is to come to New York and just treat, you know, if I'm having anxiety, getting a cab, that gives me anxiety too. And that, you know, it's raining at JFK, get an Uber, not take the train to the thing, to the bus, to a hell, you know, and then you slide down a slide, you know, plunge, and then you get off on 4th Street, you know what I'm saying? So just the freedom to extricate. When I'm with my mother, I could just bolt, you know what I mean? I went there for my father's funeral, and she's going, oh, she tried to kill herself. She took a knife, but it was plastic. It bent. And I said, I'm going to a hotel. So just the freedom that, you know, because I had anxiety years ago before I had money saved up that, what if I get kicked out? Like, yeah. So to me, money buys not possessions, but non-desperation to be creative and to extricate.
So now you've written these three books.
Yes.
Obviously, they're a source of great pleasure to you. And again, there's been an evolution. Like, you went from kind of the My Seinfeld year, where you took maybe this seminal point in your life and wrote a Kindle single about it. Then it became more a broader memoir with your second book. You know, maybe we'll have you back. And it's kind of your full career as a guest star on so many shows. And again, I will repeat, this is, you're a part of television history. You've been on every, you're the only person who's been on every single TV show. Like, I grew up with all those shows that you've been on.
You know, suddenly Susan was ahead of its time, because before they had gay guys so much on TV with Will and Grace, and I guess even before Ellen, but I played a low-key gay guy, and there was another low-key gay guy.
So yeah, well, and just in
and Kathy Griffin was going, "You're so homophobic, Fred, you're not holding hands," because we were supposed to be dancing at a wedding. So she was annoying, but what?
Or that's right, because Kathy Griffin kind of got her breakout on Suddenly Susan.
Yeah.
And then, of course, she did her reality. She's very aggressive. She did her reality show. I forgot, Adventures of the D-List or something like that.
Yeah, my life on the D-List.
And then this third book, again, kind of evolves from your broader memoir to be more almost like a journalistic, like a narrative nonfiction book.
Yeah, and it was really, it was fascinating to me, because I felt like I was part detective, part reporter, that it's really hard, because I was at the mercy of Pete to tell these five stories, and I'm so happy that I got two wives of them to cooperate. Some people wouldn't cooperate. Some people resentful, suspicious.
But even that becomes part of the story,
yes,
like in this Gonzo style.
Yes, yeah, exactly. So it really, I relived, in Seinfeld, what happened was Kenny Banya was based on a real guy. A guy gave me an Armani suit and said, "Now you got to take me out for a meal and we're even, because, you know." So we went to this Jerry's Deli, and he just got soup and soda. It came to $20. He goes, "I'm going to save the meal for another time." He did this like three times, and and that became Kenny Banya. So one guy, we went to a place in Malibu, an expensive, sushi place. And he goes, I'll take it easier on you. I'll just get appetizers. It came to $70. Then he goes, "Oh, I forgot something else about Warren Thomas and Rob Schneider. Meet me at Waffle." So we had waffles. And then he set me up. He texted someone who texted someone else, and I got another interview. It was, "Now we got to get a real meal at Nobu in Malibu." And I go, "You're just like Kenny Banya." He goes, "Well, you benefited. I should." So, and then then I'd have to hang out with this annoying guy because I wanted my story. It's like that cliche, your story, your book is your baby, and these are my babies and what you do. I'm coming to New York spending money. I mean, I'm glad to do it, but, you know, I believe in this. This is the thing I'm most proud of, because, yeah, so it's a little more dimensional than some of those other things, the fact that,
what's next?
I want to write more things. I hope I don't regress to being just about me again. I like the fact that I'm not waiting for a line producer or releases. Just I can write it. So I have some people interested, and they, you know, it's so flattering. Like, you know, all my life as a writer, I had no confidence. I try things out, and now people are saying, You from these three things have created a distinctive voice. So I have more things, either a single or another book of maybe not so showbiz-centric, but hopefully creating a persona like someone. Well, one guy said, I don't agree, Charles Bukowski, I'm not as gritty, you know, but that kind of
thing.
No,
but you have an
outsider guy. Or someone else has said the American Splendor guy. So I see that more than Charles Bukowski. But I'm finally embracing...
Like, American Splendor is the Harvey Bukar?
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm embracing that this kind of self-aware outsider, you know, guy that doesn't fit in. So I want to keep writing these stories. Like, as a writer, I know I'm not going to be some guy they're going to bring in to punch up Ratatouille 2. But, you know, I finally... This guy I met Monday, I don't want to jinx it, because, you know, you're good at writing about your experiences. And I never had the confidence... You know, to write about my own experience, because, you know, yeah.
But you know, I think in 5 minutes to kill, you don't just write about your own experiences.
Oh yeah.
You expand.
Well, I may respect it now, but. But yes, but in these other things, I
think it's really 5 minutes to kill is really about kind of these elements of success.
But
and
this other
show
thing I'm writing may seem like my experience, but I like to explore what's delusional people in my life. Am I delusional like them? That scares me. But then again, I envy delusional people. I wish I was more delusional. So I think yes, I am exploring other people through my story. You know that I'm fascinated with delusional people. Because, well, my mother said recently, I resent nervy people. And she goes, I don't like nervy people. Maybe I resent them because I wish I could be nervy. So I never had, this entitlement. So I just like kind of writing, this kind of voice where I know it's not going to be, you know, competing with the Hunger Games and stuff. Just hopefully.
You never know.
Yeah.
But, you know, it seems like you, even in this conversation, you've talked about several other ideas that could potentially fascinate you. Like, you know, the difference between, you know, the aspect of timing in a lot of show business and how you could kind of overcome that aspect potentially. Or, you know, what, you know, also kind of you've
acceptance,
been through.
Self-acceptance.
Yeah, self-acceptance. But, and also how self-acceptance might change depending on timing. So who you were in the 80s is different than what is succeeds in the 90s and the 00s and the 10s. And television and media itself changes. Like media, television now has changed so much.
You figure that,
Well, you can't have a Seinfeld show.
Exactly.
There's no show that's going to have 30 million viewers now.
Well, what I don't want to give away the stuff in my book, my new one, but a lot of people that didn't make it in the 80s or 90s could have made it now because they could have been better at podcasting, riffing. You don't have to, you could just riff and go on tangents. You don't have to have that 5 minute set, you know, that you got to kill with on TV, or you could be pop culture reference, you know. So some people are ahead of their time. Maybe I was in the wrong era with acting, but I'm really happy for what happened and didn't happen, because it leads to I finally embrace expressing it.
Well, would you say that is self-acceptance? So self-acceptance doesn't necessarily mean, oh, I'm happy all the time because I've got, you know, the mansion and this and that, and I was a star on a show. But you were, you were the character actor on many shows.
Like I said, I poo-pooed those kid shows when I did it. Ned's Declassified was a stupid show, but. But you know, this Kindle single, I don't know if it'll make the money my Seinfeld or whatever, but I just want it to be a story that gets out there, you know, and I would trade that for another Handy Manny, even though I made good money. There's nothing like for me expressing myself.
And again, it's about reinvention also in the sense that, you know, you started writing these books in your 50s, you're 59 right now, you had you've had four different careers, right? So you were stand up on the road.
You write a lot about reinventing yourself.
Yes.
But there's one thing, as we're sounding it out, I just realized, is it conscious to reinvent yourself or no, you go with what you have. See,
and you go with what excites you too.
Yes, exactly. So like I have, let's say, these other ideas, and sometimes, yes, you go where the energy, where you, there's not resistance. Like I could have done 5 minutes ago. People said, why wasn't it a documentary? And I said, well, then I have to try to get the line producer, and I've tried to do my own documentaries, and you don't see eye to eye with the guy who put the money up, the guy who shot it, and get the sound and the releases. I said, that would be great as a documentary, but what can I do that I can do now? You know, I could go around to pitch things, but I'm not the hot young guy from the Aspen Comedy Festival. I have an In It Kindle Singles. I pitched them. They said, we love this. So go with where they want you, not what you think is the home run. Go where what excites you, what's creative. And and so I don't know if reinventing is a
It's sort of half and half, because you knew you wanted to write these books.
Yes.
But you're not necessarily going to force. It has to be easy, too. You try the different things, like, oh, maybe the documentary, but no, that's hard.
You know, I shouldn't regret this, but, like, I was a stand-up. It wasn't ever my passion, but I was in a comfort zone of the comedy boom in the 80s and thinking, I'm unique, I'll be discovered. And then I came to LA. It took a while to be the character guy on TV shows. But to be honest, I wasn't really that happy because I was going, all the network of people seeing me, I'm funny. Why don't I have a regular sitcom job? And you're always on eggshells, like I said, trying to, a guest star guy can't flub a line. He's got to hit it out of the park. If his line doesn't get a laugh, he's written out. So even though he's on all these seminal shows, it was harrowing. It was, you see guest stars get written out. I did some shows, Raymond and Friends, where I was written out of the episode. They said, not because you weren't funny, the scene isn't working. But it's still, you think, am I? Then you do an episode on Raymond. I did another one where they cut me for time a lot. So it's just so nerve-wracking when, am I going to be cut out from the week? Am I cut from the scene? So it never felt creative. You're like a monkey doing flips, you know what I mean? I forgot my stupid tangent about what I'm doing. Yes, now is, so I was in a comfort zone thinking, I'm on TV, I'm making a living as an actor, this has to be right, but it didn't feel right. So it took, I'm happy that a lot of it dried out where, and it's such great timing where I did the animation where I said, this is what Fred, you have the money and the time to not be desperate. What would you like to write?
And yeah. You know, just in terms of that animation, you have a very distinctive voice, right?
Is it still even with the cold?
Oh, no, but you have a distinctive voice in general. Like, it's always this kind of depressing, sort of Brooklyn-ish voice.
Well, that's a blessing, and the curse is either they want me or not. Anytime I audition for a voiceover, I'm not going to get it. They want me because, yeah, Jewish, New York, all that stuff. So, yes. So
it was great for you. You had a whole career with voiceovers with you know, these animations.
Yeah, they're fun. But like I said, they have to want you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, no, again, it took me a while to really come to terms. But, what I'm really happy about is, you know, I don't know if you write about this and you're reinventing and everything, but I'm in the parameters of show business by, like, these are the laws, these are the rules. Like, this is pilot season. These are the seasons you make it. These are the years you're washed up. As a writer, actor, these are the years you're over. But I want to go into a creative world where there's no real rules or laws. Like, I know so many depressed comedy writers that aren't getting work anymore, actors that, I was like that for a while, going, all right, I'll hang on a few more years. Maybe I'll get my SAG pension. Because you're waiting for them to call you, or you're waiting, you know, for showbiz, or showbiz is saying you're over now. So I want to enter a world where I feel like I'm just starting now. I'm so excited with writing like this.
I mean, that's really great. And again, it's a sign that it can never be too late to reinvent. I mean, you have many books in front of you.
Yes, exactly. It's not too late. And yeah, my advice would be, don't go by what you, like, it makes sense if you're an NBA player, like, okay, when you're 40, it's over. But if you're creative, yeah.
I think there's an important part of that too, that you're doing these as Kindles or Kindle singles or whatever.
Hopefully expand more, yeah.
You don't need a publisher necessarily. You could just sort of upload, you can write them and upload them to Amazon.
Well, this actually, the 5 Minutes of Kill was, that's true, but they have now Amazon publishing. So they did the cover, legal stuff. If I get sued by this, I don't want to go into a lunatic sued me for the other one that got thrown out. But
Kenny Kramer.
Yes, yes.
We won't get into the story, but people could Google it.
Yes. So basically, I'm indemnified. It's all legal, what I'm saying.
But you didn't have to go through the hurdles of like getting an agent and dealing with one of the main publishers. Like you.
Well, but I'm saying it's under Amazon Publishing, but you could do it independently if you want.
Right.
So it wasn't self-published, but it was. But you can, yes. It's more competitive than when my Seinfeld year was on app because they did have all the, now so many people are hip to Kindle singles and self-publishing, and there are people making a lot of money from it. Yes.
Well, again, Fred Stoller, author of 5 Minutes to Kill, fascinating book. You know, I just want to mention, I'm trying at my late age, every week I'm going and performing stand-up right now at a local club. So it was an
Is this a passion for you?
It is a passion for me. And I'm in my 40s.
So this is like you give a lot of advice, right, on this show?
Well, I always just tell my story.
Well, the cliche is do what you love and the money will come. Now, I still make the mistake of, I think I have an in with these sketches or this. And I find myself trying to come up with ideas for stuff that's not really my passion because I think I have an in. And to me, what's most rewarding and what always pays off is if it's your passion, not because, Fred, I run a website where we do bits about skiing. I'm making up the most nonsense. So I'm trying, I'll be the crazy skier in the, in every week report from a thing. And that's more desperate because I know someone in skiing. Oh, I could give you this, a skiing website. You know what I'm saying? When to me, it's best when it's, this is what I want to express.
Well, that's the thing is that I'm not trying to make a career as a comedian, but I just love learning this new skill. And it's been such a pleasure. And that's, in part why I read all your books, because it's like kind of this history of stand-up comedy and being a comic writer.
Tonight at 7, I'm not doing a set, but I'm doing the Comedy Cellar podcast with Dan Natterman. If you want to meet any of those guys, you're
I've
free.
Been on the Comedy Cellar podcast with Dan Natterman. Say hi to Dan.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So Fred Staller, 5 Minutes to Kill is his latest book, which I highly recommend, but also My Seinfeld Year is fascinating to see kind of inside the scenes of a season at Seinfeld. And also, maybe we'll have you back kind of your whole career as
the life of the perennial guest star.
Yeah, life of the perennial guest star. So thanks, Fred, for coming on the podcast.
Thank you. Everyone was so nice here. Yeah. I'm sorry I can't shake hands because I'm considerate. I never know when people walk around with the mask. Is it because they're sick or they don't want others to get sick?
I think it's because they put the mask on because they don't want to get polluted by New York.
Oh, I thought they're being so considerate. Like,
no,
I have
no,
a flu.
Nobody's considerate.
All right. I thought, I have a flu. I don't want to get you people sick as I walk through this crowded street.
No.
All right. I'm going to curse them out now. They're doing it for themselves. All right.
Thanks,
this is a lot of fun. Thank you so much.
That was great.
Yeah, it was great.
For more from James, check out The James Altucher Show on the Choose Yourself Network at jamesaltucher.com and get yourself on the free insiders list today.
Hey, everyone. Thanks so much for listening to this episode. I really hope you enjoyed the show. Before you go, I wanted to just say thank you to everyone who has rated and reviewed this podcast on iTunes. For instance, I'm going to give like a little humble, it's not even a humble brag. It's like an ego brag. Tim at AgGrad, AGGRAD, said, "This is my favorite podcast by far. Seriously, not hyperbole. James is a genius. He researches guests extensively and always seems to deliver the perfect question at the perfect time. He has a very high standard for guests. Every episode makes me think. Highly recommend." Tim, that was a really great review. Thank you. I'm going to try, hopefully, to keep the same standard of questions and we'll see. But I really enjoy reading these. So, Tim, it means a lot to me, and I'm grateful for your support.
You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.